Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. I'm speaking today with Joan Rothschild. She's Professor Emerita at UMass Lowell. She's now at the Center for Human Environments at the Graduate Center at the City University of New York. And she is a longtime scholar of feminist approaches to technology, author of Machina Ex Dea, Feminist Perspectives on Technology. And most recently, she's the author of The Dream of the Perfect Child. Welcome, Joan.
Oh, thank you for interviewing me, if that's what I was supposed to say.
Oh, it's my pleasure. The dream of the perfect child is critical of the way that reproductive technologies and prenatal testing and other technologies have impacted women's lives. So tell us, which technologies in particular are you examining in the dream of the perfect child? And then we'll get into some of your perspective on them.
Okay, well, at first, it's not all reproductive technologies by any means. I'm really just concentrating on prenatal technologies. And how they are having an effect, not just on women, but on our thinking in lots of ways about disability, about where we're going with our research, with all of this research. So it's definitely focused on that on those kinds of technologies and the science that goes with it. Because of course, if we didn't have this genetic research, there were a lot of things that they could not diagnose.
You're examining in this book the notion that technologies are allowing us to test what kind of child we're going to have and to have some kind of quality control over our future progeny.
Yes, that's true. But the point is that it's, and there's nothing wrong with. Let me maybe say that I'm not a Luddite, and I can give you the derivation of that if you want. It comes from Nottingham in the 19th century. But anyhow, I'm not someone who is against the technologies or the science. So it isn't that. It's how they are being developed, not how they're developed, but how they're being used and how we are zeroing in particularly on the so-called defectives, and that's in quotation marks. It isn't really the technologies themselves, but it's really what's happening as we bring together the existence of the technologies and the science, the doctors, the leaders, or the gatekeepers of reproductive medicine who are really gung-ho to just test every woman. The parents who want this, and how they really all come together in the doctor's office to make decisions about which children are acceptable and which are not. And it's much more the emphasis, in a way, what I should have called the book The Nightmare of the Imperfect Child, because that's really what I'm sort of getting at, is how we're really driving towards a kind of a negative eugenics, of picking up that kind of thing, because we can do this. We can't so much maybe predict what a child is going to be like and make a perfect baby, but we certainly can start to weed out those we think are imperfect. And that's what is really concerning me, of how this is happening.
Julian Savulescu is an ethicist at Oxford, and he argues that if a parent has a set of choices about which kind of children to have, that we have obligations to choose the children with the most ability. So that kind of puts the argument on the other foot to say some of these decisions that parents are making, it's not that they're trying to weed out children that they consider defective, but they're trying to make sure that the children that they do have the most abilities in life. Isn't that a more positive way to look at it?
Well, except that that's not really possible. I mean, in other words, that you can, yes, try to assure that there'll be certain kinds of diseases and conditions that a child will not suffer from. you can try to choose your partner in such a way so that you hope that that partner will bring certain kinds of abilities there, and hope that two intelligent parents might get an intelligent child. But beyond that, I don't think that's really what the motives are. I'm not saying that they don't want the best and most attractive and intelligent child that they can have, but the thing is, the route to get there is to look for the imperfect. You see what I mean? In other words, it's the perfect by default.
Well, let's take the example of Down syndrome, which is one of the more common screens.
And the one that the literature is full of.
Yeah. Well, so if you are a parent and you have the option to make a child who does have retardation or Down syndrome or doesn't have retardation or Down syndrome, isn't it the parent's ethical responsibility, not only their right, but their ethical responsibility to make that decision?
No, I don't think it has anything to do particularly with ethics. I think that, first of all, I don't like to have Down's children characterized as retarded. I think that's part of the thing, the language. I have learned an enormous amount doing this book and realizing of how strongly people with disabilities, my chapter on that was just an eye-opener for me to do. And so I think that we don't really understand really what this is all about. Of course they should have the choice. I am pro-choice in every way that one can think of, but the thing is that they should have that choice as to whether they do want to have a child with Down syndrome or not. They should have that choice. But the thing is, they should also understand the kind of decision they're making at least their personal level, and what that means. And most cases, it is a personal level. There's no question about that. I have no quarrel with that.
So you think a lot of parents are under some kind of pressure from physicians or from society to abort a fetus that's determined to have Downs without being fully informed about what the consequences of Downs might be for that child's life?
Yes, I think this is perfectly true. And I think that there's a National Down Syndrome Society, which has been working very hard to try to inform people just what life is like for Down's syndrome children. And again, I mean, there is that choice, but there's no question that there has been much more media attention now to the fact that this is not necessarily, in other words, that one might make the choice in another way.
Well, it seems a little odd to focus on the notion that there might be this kind of pressure in our society, which undoubtedly there is on some parents, when about 40% of the population thinks that it's unethical to have to allow legal abortion in the case of a disabled child in the first place, and would not, and many of those Christian, you know, oriented parents wouldn't consider abortion for themselves. So, you know, in that sense, it seems like the overwhelming pressure in our society is a pronatalist pressure to not have an abortion in the case of Downs.
Well, the thing is, I don't know where your statistic comes from, because I have been asked that question when I've done talks, and I have not been able to find anything about in the anti-choice lobby of people on that, because so many of the surveys that I have seen, and maybe there are newer ones, this is something I was looking for and couldn't find, was that that a very great majority of the people in this country do say that it is okay to abort if there is usually they say serious defect in the baby or something like that. That's sort of a phrase that is often used. And I don't know, you know, I have to take your statistic. I haven't found that, I think it's an interesting one.
You're absolutely right. I mean, what I'm drawing up from is the National Opinion Research Center's General Social Survey. They've been tracking six different approval of six different reasons for abortion over the last 30 years.
Yeah.
And one of those reasons is if the child has a severe disability. Mm-hmm. And the majority of folks have always, since the 80s at any rate, supported that. But there's this substantial minority. You know, if we're talking about what kind of social pressures people are subject to, I think there are far fewer people who would criticize somebody for not having an abortion of a Down syndrome child than would criticize them for having an abortion.
Because that's the kind of thing, and I think the peer pressure. I mean, I used to live in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and of course, again, that's a particular area and so on, so the anecdotal evidence is of a particular milieu. But nevertheless, I mean, you would get the stories from people one knows, and if a woman decides not to, and the women who do refuse to test, and then they have a child with Down syndrome, and you hear the mutterings, well, she didn't have to have a kid like that. I mean, that kind of thing, and that is very much in that kind of community.
Well, that's true. That may be Massachusetts specific, though. Well, I'm speaking with Joan Rothschild. She's the author of The Dream of the Perfect Child. This is Change Surfer Radio, and I'm Dr. J, and The Dream of the Perfect Child is about this issue of the context that choices about prenatal testing and quality control over your future progeny come about in. It seems like another one of the themes that you're touching on is the notion that has become more popular with a couple recent books, that choices, the proliferation of choices in modern society is in some ways oppressive and depressive, that people are paralyzed by the increasing number of choices. And many people's reaction to the choices around reproduction seems to be that life would be a lot simpler if we didn't have any of these choices and we just accepted whatever God gave us.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure that I agree with that particular critique of the fact that we have so many choices. I don't think we have a lot of choices. I always like to think about the cereals in the supermarket. If you want a cereal that doesn't have a lot of sugar and junk and everything else, you supposedly have, I don't know what the number are there. Your choices are really very limited. Having choice means being able to structure your choice. And most of us don't structure that choice, or TV programs or anything else. That so much of that is given, and sometimes you just, your choice is not to do it, to turn off the TV set or to buy wheat germ. I think that in reproduction, I'm not sure there is really that much choice in terms of what you can do, because the kinds of things you can test for are still very limited, and it sets up a lot of anxiety. Of course, there's anxiety about... A genetic counselor told me, she said, I have never seen a pregnant woman who wasn't anxious about her baby being normal. I mean, of course, there is the anxiety and what you do about it, but I'm not sure that we've increased the choices. That's what my point. I think the premise may be not there. I'm sounding very academic.
It may be anecdotal, but I understand that one of the kind of sociobiological universals of human women is that as soon as their children are born, they count fingers and toes to make sure that they're normal in some sense. So that doesn't seem to be, you know, that doesn't seem to be necessarily a product of false consciousness under capitalism. Mm-hmm. That may be just something that we all want, is to have healthy children.
Oh, yeah. I don't think there's anything. I mean, another story, I don't know whether you saw I remember my mother being on the phone when I'm a kid, and she's talking to someone who's obviously just had a baby, and I remember her saying, just be glad your child is healthy. And I'm sure that what the woman had a boy instead of a girl, or a girl instead of a boy. And I mean, I remember hearing that as a child. So this is certainly, I don't disagree with what you're saying, that people want the best for their kids. There's absolutely no reason why they shouldn't.
Well, one of the other arguments coming out of, you know, the academic left myself, one of the other arguments I'm very sensitive to, and I'm not always avoiding myself, is the notion that when people make choices that I don't think are as fully informed or as politically conscious as they should be, that they're laboring under false consciousness, and that therefore, you know, we should restrict or guide their choices in some way. And I think that comes through in some feminist critiques, not necessarily yours, but some feminist critiques of reproductive technology. Some people are saying, women are brainwashed by patriarchy into thinking that they should have X, Y, and Z, and therefore we should take it away from them.
Okay, well, that's what the radical feminist position, which I do not agree with. And if you, in the beginning of chapter 10, I go through this, and of why, I mean, I do not see women as victims. And I do not oppose. And besides, I'm only talking about one particular area of reproductive technology, not IVF or other things. And I don't agree with that position. I do think that when women, and it's particularly women of older women who are deemed the highest risk to have some kind of something wrong with their child. When there are the pressures on them, they can become complicit furthering the technology and not thinking about where it may be going. That's all. But that's a matter of being caught up in it. But I do not see women as victims. I think they are much more objectified. I think the focus on the fetus and looking for the diseased or defective fetus. I mean, years ago, the focus was on the woman. You have to eat right, you have to take care of yourself, and so on. And, of course, you would hope that your child was going to be okay. What you have now is a real just turning around 180 degrees. Now it's the focus on the fetus. Somehow the woman, she just doesn't exist there anymore. And she isn't given the role, or she doesn't given the role. She doesn't have the role as an agent in her pregnancy. She as someone who can manage her pregnancy. Somehow it's managed. The term management that's come over from business comes into managing a pregnancy, and somehow she becomes part of that. And so again, somehow she becomes complicit in it. There's no question about it.
Let me turn that around, because I think that there's a way in which critics of reproductive technology and prenatal choice have also become complicit in the focus on the fetus. And recently, mm-hmm. I was listening to a BBC documentary about sex selection in India. Mm-hmm. The young Indian feminist mm-hmm. was talking about this issue, and I'm sure that she's pro-choice in many mm-hmm. other respects. But when it came to talking about sex selection, she started talking about feticide.
Mm-hmm.
And so suddenly, you know, you go mm-hmm. from talking about being pro-choice and the right to abortion to talking about how terrible it is to kill fetuses, and there didn't seem to be any cognitive dissonance there. And the same thing happens with disability rights. Recently, the disability rights folks at the UN were trying to argue that no woman should have the right internationally to abort a disabled fetus because the disabled fetuses had rights.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that that's very problematic. That's troubling.
Well, I agree with you. I think feminists who in the disability community have taken a rather interesting position, and I think it's a difficult one. They're pro-choice. They say that that they would never interfere with a woman's right to choose. They do criticize some feminists for saying that that to abort for a disability is a reason to support abortion. They disagree with that. But they argue that once the child is born, even if it is in very, very bad shape, that it must be treated, it becomes a person. In other words, once the child becomes a person and is a living being outside the womb, then this is Adrian Ash and Michelle Fine, who did a book several years ago on this, and that's in their book. And that, I think, is their position. Now, that's a feminist disability position of people who have talked and written about disability. And that is certainly a position that I think there's some cognitive dissonance, but that's the way they resolve the problem there. But for myself, I feel this way about the issue of sex selection. It's first of all my book, by the way, is mainly about the U.S. and Western society. That the sex selection, I don't think is. Well, it's very hard to get statistics on this because people won't tell you the real reason. But I think that it becomes a template for aborting for social rather than medical reasons. And that's the kind of issue that I think the sex election brings up, which I think is a much more interesting one, because if then the choices, if we could ever make them, that would be on social grounds rather than medical grounds, then we start getting into some real difficulties. And that, I think, is where sex selection is. Now, I'm not talking about India and the other countries. They've outlawed it, but it still goes on. And I can't do anything about their culture. I think the culture here is less clear as to whether there's that strong a motivation to do that.
But let me press another aspect of the argument, which is that part of the critique of the way, ever since Barbara Ehrenreich back in the 70s and others, of the nature of these decisions is the inegalitarian relationship between wives and their husbands and women and their doctors. And don't you think that that is changing? In other words, mm-hmm. that women are becoming increasingly empowered, partly because of the women's health movement, both in their relationships mm-hmm. with their husbands and with their doctors, in ways that would change the dynamic around the things that you find troubling about these decisions?
Well, I think this is perfectly true. I think that the change in the doctor-patient relationship, which has become a more reciprocal one, is certainly one that is changing. But I don't know whether the power relations that exist there, because it's not just male-female, it's doctor-patient, it's also age, because the top doctors in the field, who of course are doing more of the research and are backing spreading prenatal diagnosis as widely as possible, they are still the older doctors. And so on. So there is an imbalance. I just don't think that that's really a huge factor involved. I think it's much more of the societal views about perfection and imperfection. And my book goes into tracing this back to the 18th century when we wanted to make perfect people, and then we got to into the 19th century when we distorted the way of how we wanted to do this. And, I mean, I think that there is a whole societal view of how we look at both becoming perfect and improving and being imperfect that I think is its part of. I know it gets, I'm making a big leap, but I think that what's happening in that doctor's office, and that's part of my point in the book, is that it's happening within reproductive medicine, even though we don't realize that thousands of decisions are being made that certify certain children as unwanted and others as wanted, and that's what we should be looking at. But I don't know whether whether there's that much of an imbalance. I think there is a much more of a climate that it takes place in, and so that the individual dynamic may be changing a little. And that still doesn't mean that the woman doesn't fully and the parents don't fully agree that this is a good thing that they should be doing. In other words, that they should test and then make a particular kind of decision, depending on the outcome.
You know, there's one way in which I'm very sympathetic. And when my son was born, he had a very small anatomical anomaly. And we went in to talk to the pediatric surgeon about it. And he said, well, you want to have this corrected, of course, because when he goes to the gym and into the locker room, everyone's going to see it. And I said, well, it'll be a point of conversation. why would it necessarily be a problem that people see this? He'll just be, it'll be one thing he'll have to show off to his dates, you know? Mm-hmm. And so there are ways in which these concepts of biological normality mm-hmm. are being enforced. But I think it's very different for something that is non-functional and something that's functional. So, for instance, you know, I'm much more troubled by parents who don't see, who think that it's perfectly fine to choose a deaf embryo as a part of a reproductive decision making mm-hmm. Because they happen to be deaf themselves and don't think that hearing is a valuable thing for their children to have.
Yeah.
And well, yeah, go ahead.
No, there was that case, and because I was just in the UK and somebody brought that up, that there had been that case in England and so on. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, just, that's the kind of situation in which, you know, there are some kinds of prenatal decisions about preferences, aesthetic preferences that parents might have, which are not functional. Mm-hmm. And there are others which actually could reduce the function and ability of their children in the next generation. And choosing not to abort, you know, some would or could argue that choosing not to abort in the situation of severe disability is actually choosing to bring a child into the world who will not have those functions, mm-hmm. when you could have brought a child into the world in your next round of reproduction who didn't have that problem.
Yeah. Well, again, I guess I'm going to sort of wiggle out of that because I don't really have an opinion about it. I just don't think we can interfere. And I guess what I'm saying is that I'm not sure we can. I mean, the whole idea of control, and I mean, I'd be very much against certain kind of state, control of things like that. At the same time, we should have regulation of fertility clinics. We don't have regulations about a whole bunch of things, about sperm donation, or we have some, but very little. Those kinds of things need to be regulated.
So, I hear you saying that the technologies may be giving parents the illusion of control that they might not actually have in their lives.
Oh, there's no question about that. The pediatrician Perry Klass, who's written a lot, back in the late 80s, she had an article in the New York Times magazine about not being, you know, can we make a perfect baby? And she said it's not possible, and so on, and laid it out very carefully then. And yet the idea, the term perfect is, I mean, I think it's used metaphorically often. You know, I want this child to be perfect and so on, and I want to have a perfect baby. Sure, it's used in that sense. But the idea that somehow that you're going to test and or you're going to screen first and then if something's found, you're going to test and diagnose specifically, that somehow, or if you screen and there's no indication, that you have to go further, because that's what is growing more and more even in the first trimester, your kid's going to be fine. I mean, there's nothing to worry about. And of course, as you say, I think it's an illusion, and I think it's a cruel illusion, because what's sort of pushed under the rug is that they're really very frightened. Underneath it, they go through the testing because they're scared, and I think it ups that anxiety quotient. Maybe it doesn't. I mean, maybe there is some reassurance, because that's one of the reasons that women want to be tested.
Well, maybe in the next round of your book, you should look at women taking anti-anxiety drugs and see.
Yeah,
that could be the answer to the anxiety introduced by these technologies.
Yeah, but I mean, this is true, and again, it's all the way down the line and across classes and so on. We haven't even talked about that.
Right. Well, this is an enormous topic, and we could go on and on. So I look forward to your further work. And I've been speaking with Joan Rothschild. She's the author of The Dream of the Perfect Child, which is a critique and exploration of prenatal testing, and also of many other works on feminist perspectives on technology. Professor Emerita UMass Lowell, and lives in New York now. Thanks so much for joining us today, Joan.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts with me, Dr. J, you can contact me at jhughes@changesurfer.com. That's jhughes@changesurfer.com. Or you can read my Change Surfing columns at betterhumans.com, or check out the collaborative Cyborg Democracy blog I participate in at cyborgdemocracy.net. Or you can read my new book, Citizen Cyborg. For more details about Citizen Cyborg, visit cyborgdemocracy.net. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the A-Infos radio project. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.